Late in his years, I came to know Cary McWilliams, who wrote Southern California Country and Island on the Land. And Cary McWilliams was one of those profound chroniclers and yet wise interpreters of the peculiarities of the communities in which we live in Southern California. I never expected to have another person like that who so clearly mirrored the images for us, the blemishes, the increasing fissures, and make us deal with what the reality is. But we do have someone like that, and he's here with us today. His name's Mike Davis. He's the author of City of Quartz. Mike has just recently completed an article for The Nation magazine, which will be in the next issue, about what's happened in Los Angeles over the last 2 weeks. But I think the insights that Mike will bring to you today about what's happened, what we've seen happening, the signs that came along the way that we didn't pay enough attention to, will truly be enlightening, and I think will help prepare all of us. And we feel very, very lucky to have him with us today.
I want to talk to you today a bit about the social forces that have produced this uprising in Los Angeles. But before I can do that, I have to, what in highfalutin terms we'd say deal with the epistemology of this, which is simply the question of how do we know what we think we know about what happened in this city? And this is the Kerner Commission report, now a rare collector's item. Repressed in the collective memory of America. But one of the interesting things about the Kerner Commission's approach to the study of the inner-city insurrections of 1967 was that it totally threw out the explanations advanced in almost all the other reports, including Los Angeles's McCone Commission, as having any analytic value at all, and cautioned the readers of its report that what the news media and most of the country were kind of flippantly dismissing as riots, or rather as race riots, was something, in its own words it said, far more irregular, complex, and absolutely unpredictable. And in a sense, the great advance of the Kerner Commission study over these other riot commission study was precisely this admission, that each of the insurrections that occurred had a particular complex local history. It also had a perhaps shared, a common, role in a national crisis. But that attention had to be given to, the complexities of that local history and of the events that produced something which in turn could not be reduced to a single essence or a single image. So how do we know what we think we know about LA? I guess I should begin probably with a kind of mea culpa, an apology, which is why do I, or for that matter most of us here, have any right to even talk about this event before we've heard the voices of the people who are actually the participants in this event. About a week ago I was at a conference, news conference held in Inglewood under the auspices of Imam Aziz, a local Muslim leader that brought together the Bloods and Crips sets in Inglewood for the purposes of announcing a peace in what has been actually, an incredibly bloody gang war in Inglewood for the past decade. And it was the first chance that most of the media had to hear any of the kids that they've spent years talking about and vilifying. And one of the kids made an interesting comment, and he turned to the news media, and he says, this riot has been our media. It's been, our way of being heard. And of course, everything that's happened in this city will be in vain unless we ensure that those voices are heard. And it seems to me that we're talking especially about two voiceless communities in Los Angeles. One are gang youth, about whom we probably know the absolute least in terms of what their real intentions, beliefs, what lies in their hearts. And in the last week, we've seen some remarkable things come to light, one of which is nothing less than what purports to be a Bloods and Crips program for the reconstruction of Los Angeles. It's called Give Us the Hammer and Nails and We'll Rebuild the City. And if anything, this document shows the dangers of stereotyping or underestimating the capacities of this generation of kids in the inner city, or underestimating their political intelligence. Of course, the other group, voiceless group, for whom the riot became a media, were members of the immigrant communities of Los Angeles, particularly the latest layers of immigrants, Mexican immigrants, Salvadoran and Guatemalan immigrants, in the Pico Union and MacArthur Park areas. So my point is simply that what I say today, or what anyone who claims to be an analyst or a journalist writing about these events says, is far less important than the voices of the participants and understanding their motives and their ideas about their activity. And if those voices aren't brought, if we don't hear those voices, then in a sense the riot would have to happen all over again. And one of the great tragedies in the history of Los Angeles was the McCone Commission's utter failure to hear the voices of the community. There were only two or three people even allowed to testify at any length before the McCone Commission. So all the McCone Commission really heard were the voices already in its minds, its prefabricated beliefs about what had happened. Now, turning to the way that the media has processed and made this event into spectacle, it seems obvious to say that the media started out with its own presuppositions about people's activity and simply continued to deepen and make those more banal during the entire course of its coverage. The Kerner Commission has a whole section devoted to the media coverage of the 1967 riots, and it makes absolutely necessary reading today, because almost every critique it makes of the television coverage in 1967 applies. The failure to provide context to people's action, the failure to depict any of the underlying conditions that brought about the rebellion, the whole emphasis on lurid violent acts, the failure to include community spokesmen, the nature of and race of most of the newscasters covering it, so on and so forth. All of these things which the Kerner Commission pointed out as deficits in the media coverage of the 67 insurrections are true with kind of redoubled force today. Because although the same prejudices, the same shortcomings, the same biased vision has been brought to the inner city, the news media itself is simply far more powerful and potent. I mean, this riot coverage differs from the others because it had this illusion of giving you a kind of total immersion in events. The roaming minicams and the helicopters created a spectacle far more powerful than what we saw in the 1970s. They kind of reduced the difference. They created this hallucination that you were right there in the streets, caught up in the actuality of it, when in fact you were only seeing broken parts, edited bits and pieces of an extremely complex process. I mean, it was only, I think, yesterday or the day before, for instance, that the Los Angeles Times published an account of the events that immediately preceded the beating of the white truck driver. And indeed, their account was buried in an article largely devoted to the heroism of the working cops of the 77th Division. But if you manage to get through this kind of sickening praise for the cops in the middle of the article, it revealed that, in fact, there had been this incident where the police had chased and beaten up and hogtied a high school kid and later had to release him because they had nothing to hold him on. But it was obvious that this was one of the events, this was one of the provocations that made people so angry at the corner of Normandy and Florence. But, of course, most of us don't know that happened. Most people haven't heard that. All they've seen is the result of those provocations. All they've seen is the raw anger. A black civil rights leader in Detroit once said that the black man is the white man's intelligence test. And I think white people in this city have scored some of probably the lowest IQs in history. I was sitting in a diner the other day just listening decent people. I mean, decent people who probably consider themselves not to be racist at all, talking about the Denny incident. And the whole thing was they hate us. They would kill any of us. Why is their anger so, you know, so intense, you know, in total? And I kept thinking back to this, boy, you have flunked the intelligence test. But I mean, the news media has abetted this in such an invidious way, you know, by robbing us of those context, of those conditions, of showing us just those bits and pieces of events. Even more harrowing, and quite frighteningly, while it's brought all the black-on-white, black-on-Latino violence to the forefront, it's shown almost nothing of the police violence in the course of the uprising. The foreign press has. It's very interesting. In some of the foreign papers, you find images of people being, beaten and kicked and you know, otherwise brutalized by the police. But if you saw the LA Times special color photograph section, there was none of that. There's hardly any of it in TV. And the absence of those images, of course, has distorted the whole discussion of the criticism of the police. The Webster Commission, on the basis of its present brief, seems to be only investigating problems in police deployment and why the police were passive at the beginning, why the police didn't shoot looters or something. And it's incredibly important that pressure is applied to ensure that this commission also investigates innumerable instances of police brutality and also investigates each and every one of the deaths that occurred in the course of the riot. But the most catastrophic failure of the news media at all is while it's covered something it's called the riot, and it's shown black rage. It's also shown Latino rage, though it was never capable of even making that distinction in the images it was showing you. I mean, you recall during the first two or three days, the commentators were constantly going on and on and on about black youth, when very often you were seeing people of other colors and ethnicities on the screen. But the most catastrophic failure of the news media is that it's utterly failed to represent what must be the largest repression, the largest series of mass arrests, the most draconian crackdown that we've seen since the Nixon administration. The 18,000 people arrested, apprehended, most of them after the looting ended from Friday on, the massive overcharging that's going on, the federalization of the mop-up and repression, because it prefigures what will happen in other American cities, the layering of new kinds of federal charges on top of other charges, the likelihood that the racketeer-influenced corrupt organizations law would be brought in to add on even more felonies, and just incredible abuses. The suspension of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights downtown for a period of 2 weeks where some demonstrations were allowed, others weren't allowed. The innumerable instances which the Central American Refugee Center is now reported of people having the doors kicked in or the police come in their homes. And if you have a new sofa or TV set and you can't produce a bill of sale of being charged with a felony and arrested, of the 610 people, known people so far, totally uncharged, unaccused of any crime, but nonetheless deported from Los Angeles by the INS with the complicity of the LAPD against city policy in the last couple of weeks, so on and so forth. I mean, this amounts to, literally, one of the most serious repressions we've seen in the last 20 years. And I just wonder who in the rest of the world and the rest of the country is aware of the severity of this. Five times the number of people arrested in 1965, much stiffer charges. So the whole role of the news media has been to deny context, to suppress the motives of people's action, to show their images but never to broadcast their words, and to make this classical kind of guillotining of the riot as such from the repression that follows it. And for historians, of course, this is not a new problem. All the lurid acts of revolutions are well known. The blood of counter-revolutions hardly enters into history books. You know about the the Red Terror, but you never hear, you know, about the, you know, the White Terror. It seems to me then that along with the incredible priority of listening to and hearing the voices of people involved in this, the second priority is to bring focus and attention to the repression that's occurred and to the ominous precedent it sets for how the Bush administration, or for that matter, any Democratic administration, the likes of Mel, you know, Levine or Anthony Bielenson, you know, or any of the other law and order Democrats may take part in, the likelihood that this is the model that we'll see in the rest of the country. So anyway, having said all this about the problem of knowing what we know about the uprising in Los Angeles, I want to try and quickly advance a little potted theory of what's happened. I've been very intrigued by the different characterizations that have been advanced of the character of these events. The news media, of course, has gone from the first week of making it an almost entirely black event, a race riot, to now depicting it as some kind of insurrection of the have-nots in Los Angeles, at least in the print media. Progressive analysts seem to have swung between two extremes. On one extreme, there are people who have characterized it as the first, you know, rainbow uprising, the first multiracial united uprising of the have-nots. On another extreme, probably best represented by the article that Harold Meyerson, the editor of the LA Weekly, and a member of the Democratic Socialist America, the article that he wrote both in the Weekly, but it's also available in the New Republic, characterizes this as a kind of fundamentally as a kind of social nihilism, a Hobbesian state of war of all against all, just a total inter-ethnic gridlock of hatred and violence that's been unleashed because of the weakness and atrophy of the labor movement in progressive politics in Los Angeles. So you have these, you know, two competing definitions. Is this the first, you know, multiracial rainbow uprising, or rather is it the kind of descent into an inferno of, you know, inter-ethnic, you know, interracial violence without any, you know, larger motive or purpose? Well, obviously what is wrong with either of these characterizations is that they're essentialists. They try and find in the complex events of the last 3 weeks, you know, a single meaning, a single essence, a single characterization, when obviously what's happened in this city is a very complex social event that by its nature is a hybrid. It contains different angers, different social process, different actors, sometimes, you know, convergent in their action and intention, at other times simply existing in a kind of parallel way, in space and time. I remember going down to Pico Union area on Thursday at the height of the looting, and then later comparing notes with somebody who'd gone down there about an hour or 2 hours before I was there. I spent several hours on a street corner with a lot of looters, and it struck me that the atmosphere was one of fiesta. There was people were actually helping each other loot and holding up gratings, and I mean, there was a real feeling of community there. And the person who, in fact, one woman came up to me and she said, you know, I don't think this is stealing. I think it's rather like a TV show where we all get to win, don't you? But the person who'd been there an hour before that, he talked about a river of anger. And he was totally sympathetic to that anger, but he talked about a river of anger flowing through the MacArthur Park District in terms of the people who first broke the windows and, you know, initiated the looting. And it just became clear to me that our accounts of events weren't discrepant. We were simply talking about different points in time and different groups of people. And that any analysis of what had happened would have to take account of those two different social groups involved in it. Now, in a nutshell, I simply want to argue that this riot has had three major components. It's had a revolutionary democratic component that links it to the insurrections of the 1960s. It's had an inner ethnic component, at times almost like a pogrom. And it's also been the first, well, you could call it maybe the first postmodern bread riot, which has in fact been a multi-ethnic, you know, rising of the poor in this city. And the difficulty in trying to characterize this event is that these these three things, these three dimensions, tended to be going on simultaneously. And so you have an event that whose implications and meaning is highly contradictory. And you can find causes for despair in this series of events, but you can also find resources of hope. And I'll just talk briefly about these three layers. And I just put this out to you as a set of hypotheses, because as I say, no one can assume the authority of saying this is what happened. We're just still in the process of understanding it and engaged in dialogue with the people who participated. In the riots of 67, the Kerner Commission observed that most of these riots were caused by basically trivial instances. It was such a reservoir of grievance and so many prior incidents, it was like a supersaturation of racism, where almost any incident could then all of a sudden crystallize all the grievances. So the thing that actually set off the riots was not that important. Obviously, what's happened here is entirely opposite. The Rodney King trial has become a kind of international test, I think, of the meaning of African-American citizenship in this society. It's not merely a question of justice. It's a question of what, you know, 450 years of struggle has been all about, where in the face of the entire world, very clear who's guilty, you know, and why, and whether that simple, minimal, you know, justice can be rendered. And in that sense, the Rodney King incident becomes a counterpart of such landmarks in the history of American racism, the African-American struggle for equality, you know, is Dred Scott, or a whole series of other, you know, constitutional, you know, watersheds that have tested the meaning of black citizenship in the United States. And I say it has a revolutionary democratic content to it, simply because each of those crises has usually been resolved around the fact that those equal rights, that citizenship, will not be satisfied in the minimal way, you know, through the institutions of this society. It's been the failure of justice, the failure of supposedly democratic institutions. So it's forced the struggle for just elementary democratic rights to take a different form, and sometimes an insurrectionary form. And this was certainly the case in Los Angeles, and it's certainly true of all the actions around the country, from Las Vegas to Toronto, from Berkeley, you know, to Atlanta, that acted in coordination, in sympathy, or solidarity with events in Los Angeles. Because it becomes obvious that the struggle for that minimum democratic rights of citizenship has to flow back in the streets. The institutions have failed us, not just a group of white jurors, largely white jurors in the Simi Valley, but the institutions have, you know, have failed, and the whole world's been reading that meaning. Of course, on the streets of South Central LA, people's motivations might be determined a little differently. If you talked to a lot of youth who were out in the streets, they would keep telling you things like Rodney King's only the trigger. You know, we have so many grievances. We have so many dead homeboys. We've seen so many people of color murdered in this city. And this forces you to confront Los Angeles's quite extraordinary history, which is for no less than 50 years and probably longer, the African-American community and its allies in Los Angeles have been struggling to establish a single precedent of justice in regard to police treatment of blacks. As we all know, there's not been a year, some years there's scarcely been a month, that there hasn't been a new martyr in Los Angeles. There hasn't been an African American who's been brutalized, usually killed by the police or sheriffs. There's been probably 40 different defense committees in the lifetime of some of the people in this room. Never once, not on any single occasion, has justice been meted out to African Americans. The police have won without exception every single case. And it's the weight of that history, where there's not even a symbolic victory, where there's been, you know, no safety valve, that exploded Wednesday 2 weeks ago. It's also been the fact of this extraordinary so-called war on gangs and drugs conducted by the LAPD, which has succeeded in criminalizing youth of color in the city without exception. It's removed any social or class exemption, certainly the middle class African American youth might enjoy. They end up on the ground just the same as their brothers and sisters from poor parts of the community. And of course, this has been a repression, a campaign that's been widely tolerated by liberals in this city. I mean, it strikes me that one of the things that we have to discuss frankly and openly today is why, when Operation Hammer began and the civil liberties of black youth in the city were reduced to less than zero, most of the civil liberties establishment in the city chose not to focus on it. You know, we're more absorbed in other causes. Turned it back to, we're seeing the consequences of that today. Not to go on. The second process of revolt and anger visible in these events, of course, is an inter-ethnic tension. The black youth in the community who rose up on that Wednesday fought the police, you know, and acted, as I said, in a revolutionary democratic way, took it back to the streets. But the Armageddon that so many people had predicted, including almost any of the rank-and-file cops who might ever had any occasion to have conversations with, and I did once being arrested a couple of years ago, have a chance to hear how, you know, young cops felt about the situation. And they were all convinced that there was this Armageddon coming where the police would square off against the gangs and, you know, and there would be 10,000 people dead. And this was their equivalent of Vietnam. And the police believe in this stuff, in this mythology. And they both relish it and are terrified by it at the same time. Well, that didn't happen. You know, youth were not largely suicidal. And there was, in fact, some, I think, system of mutual deterrence operating. The police realized that they simply could not go all out and just start blowing people away, as they did in 65, when probably half or majority of the people killed were actually just people looters who were just mowed down by the police. But instead, in a way, the systematic and very political destruction was visited on the Korean merchant community. And that's not to deny that very important African-American institutions were burned and destroyed, that Latino merchants didn't suffer, both in South Central and in Hollywood and MacArthur Park. But you can't get around the fact that Korean stores were systematically targeted, and the vast majority of them in South Central LA have been burnt to the ground. And of course, again, the news media did a fundamental disservice in the first 3 or 4 days of all this by hardly ever, in fact, I don't know, on any occasion, mentioning the name that more than Rodney King was actually on the lips of youth in the community, which was Latasha Harlins. And the failure to secure justice for his 15-year-old child murdered by a store owner, I mean, it's been as fundamental to these events, at least in Los Angeles, as the beating of Rodney King. But of course, events went beyond simply, you know, Latasha Harlins, and have led to a chasm that might become an abyss between the, you know, the black and Korean communities, because Korean merchants, without exception of their beliefs or their own relations with the community, you know, tended to be attacked. And this was not, I don't believe, a, you know, random or spontaneous violence at all. It had a, you know, it had a political purpose, and the purpose was to remove the ethnic entrepreneurs who were the middlemen and intermediary groups in South Central LA, and I think to clear way for, you know, possibly for black entrepreneurship. I mean, and that contradiction has to be faced, you know, openly, and its consequences for Rainbow Coalition in this city, you know, are pretty grim. The third aspect of the uprising, of course, is there was an uprising of poor people. In this sense, it was really a festival of the oppressed. Again, the news media to this very day has failed to give us the single most important piece of information that we need to understand the motives for tens of thousands of hardworking blue-collar people participating in looting. And we're here not talking about the BMW looters or the opportunists who sacked the camera shop around the corner. You know, we're talking about the thousands and thousands of ordinary people, and I think much larger numbers than in 65. 65, the UCLA did a special project, critique of the McCone Commission. They spent 2 years doing surveys in the community and established that there were at least 22,000 active participants. That is, people who actually looted, fought the police, started fires. and another 55,000 what they called passive participants, people who were on the streets watching or cheering events, but not necessarily doing anything, I think that you find that the degree of participation here is much, much larger. We may be talking about 40 or 50,000 active participants and 200,000 passive participants in the terminology of the UCLA study. But the fundamental fact that was not made available to anyone, not simply that you know, income and class polarization, social polarization is occurring in LA, but there's a recession on. And the impact of that recession has primarily been measured in the media by the hard luck stories of aerospace engineers in El Segundo and Burbank. But the real savage edge of that repression is cut basically through the communities of new immigrants in Los Angeles, where unemployment rates have tripled, and where there is largely no social safety net to absorb any of the impact of the recession. And whether you look at it from Bell Gardens, or you know, from Florence Firestone, or Vernon Central, or Pico Union, or Hollywood, it's the same. People are in free fall. I mean, their lives are literally falling apart as they lose those minimum wage jobs. And you see the symptoms of it, if you want to see the symptoms, almost everywhere. Before Christmas, 20,000 largely Latino women and their children waiting all night for turkeys and blankets. Why? A single story in the LA Times about welfare rolls tripling. The appearance of new colonies of the homeless, but no longer just of single men, but of whole families. Latino homeless on the top of Crown Hill, in the bed of the LA River. Everywhere around us, a recession turned into a depression and destroying the hopes of the immigrants, particularly the latest levels of immigrants, and their children in the schools. I mean, one of the most harrowing statistics I heard was Mike Hernandez was trying to speak to the Neighborhood Watch in my local community. These are mainly ex-60s left liberal people whose main interest now is getting as many cops, or if not cops, private police on the block as possible. And he tried to explain to them that in our neighboring high school, Belmont High School, was one of the most overcrowded in the United States with 4,500 students, that it sent thousands more out to the valley. But beyond that, there were 7,000 high school age kids in the community who weren't even in school. And they weren't out of school largely because they were taking drugs or members of gangs. They were out of school to support their families, you know, because their families were in such deep crisis. So, I mean, the volcano that erupted in looting all across the city was based on, you know, despair, and it was based on need, and it was based on a largely unperceived, unreported, unacted upon social emergency, you know, in Los Angeles. So if you take my point, if not necessarily each analytic bit, that this has been a complex and hybrid event, that it's involved elements of revolution, of the revolutionary democratic struggle of African Americans for justice and citizenship, that it's involved, you know, entrenched and in very problematic inter-ethnic rivalries, but it also has been, you know, an explosion of the poor and of the haves in a generally, you know, festive and non-violent way. What kind of overall political conclusion do we draw? Well, I don't think we can draw the kind of hopeless conclusions that some analysts like Harold Meyerson have, that this is just nihilism. I think we're left with a huge dilemma in terms of relations between, you know, the Korean and Black community. But we're also left at the end of the day with new resources and new causes for hope. And let me just stress two of them before I conclude, and they're the obvious ones. First of all, this riot has been a miracle. It has at least temporarily ended a gang warfare in South Central LA, which, as you know, was taking hundreds and hundreds of lives every year. As you know, any ordinary month of normalcy in Los Angeles is equivalent in its human damage, maybe not in its physical damage, to what occurred in the riot, which is why the whole idea of rebuilding LA is to me so noxious. I mean, nothing would be worse than merely rebuilding the depression and misery and powerlessness that created this, you know, this riot. But it has produced a miracle, amongst the gang youth who played a large role in this. And of course, 1965 did too. I have a picture hanging in my wall, which I'm quite haunted by, which shows an overturned police car and then a group of black youth, some of them giving the old Watts gang sign, some of them giving the Slauson sign. 65 produced 5 years of gang peace in South Central LA. It also produced the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, which is one of the things the LAPD is obviously most worried about right now. That seems to be happening. People who have largely been written off as the hardcore criminal class in the city, people who've been written off as having, any intelligent, socially responsible ideas, showed themselves capable of not only being the architects of a peace, a peace that no one expected was possible, but architects now of a whole political program. And it's now become obvious that the idea that a whole generation of youth in the inner city, which the rest of the society has thrown on the scrap heap and basically, condemned to a form of social, cultural death, refuse to accept this, have probably long understood the real nihilistic consequences of gang warfare, but have never had an opportunity, a set of conditions that made it possible for, you lay down your arms, I'll lay down my arms. That's now happened in the city. And I think progressive people in the city must find this, an enormous, cause for hope. But it's a situation that's highly unstable. And I think, from what I know now, I think it's less unstable in terms of the relationship between people who've taken this step, because I think a lot of the youth who've taken this step, both in the Bloods and Crips and the different sets that comprise them, feel that they've taken a decisive step and won't turn back on the path to unity. But it's unstable because this whole process is under vicious and almost daily attack by the police. Gang meetings in the projects for the purposes of peace have been raided by the police. The police are doing everything they can to incite it. They're circulating a leaflet, which I believe to be bogus, claiming that gangs are going around calling on other gang members to kill police and so on. It's terribly important that we pull the police off the gangs, to do everything we can to support this gang peace, and that there's somebody in this city on some political level who actually has the guts and political courage to listen to what the gangs have, to have to say, because they have a lot of ideas. They have a lot of ideas about how to bring peace to the city, how to reconstruct the city. They also, in my mind, are probably the only really social democratic political constituency in the city. This gang program that circulated around basically says uber-auth bullshit. We want $3.7 billion spent on schools, spent on physical landscape. And we want it not only for black areas, we want it for the poor Latino areas of Los Angeles. Certainly makes sense to me. Certainly seems to me something that, we should all be listening to. So the gang truce that come about, and the possibility of gang youth becoming a political constituency in this city, is something that progressives have to, have to applaud and have to support. The other, I think, most progressive outcome of this city is that particularly the Central American community now finds itself under tremendous peril. Not only because of the deportations and all the largely unreported violence and repression done to this community, because it's also clear now that temporary protected status, which 75,000 people and then all their family members, enjoy as the barrier between them and deportation, has now been made political hostage to the development of a nativist right. Just yesterday or the day before, Bush sent a letter to Christiani saying, basically, happy birthday, I'm going to extend for 1 year. I'm not going to extend temporary protected status, but I'll allow your people to stay for 1 year and we'll see what happens. This is basically what the letter said. And what that really means is the entire fate of the Salvadoran, Guatemalan refugees in Los Angeles is now up to a kind of political competition. If the Buchanan forces and those that share that belief, both in the Republican Party, in the Democratic Party, get their way, that's probably the end of temporary protective status. And, of course, this would be a catastrophe for the Central American community. Well, what source of hope do we find in that? Only that the Central American community itself, which has been so largely focused on providing support, to liberation struggles and social movements in Central America. Now, in a very big hurry, must catch up and become part of LA politics and get involved. And this is a community that a few years ago people were saying, oh, it's unorganizable. In fact, it's probably one of the most highly organized communities in Los Angeles, but it's been organized for different purposes. So I think these two things, the emergence of a highly politicized Central American community as an active component of the struggle for progressive politics and some kind of rainbow coalition and in Los Angeles, and the emergence of a gang peace and, you know, of a new political consciousness amongst the gang members, you know, must be sources, you know, of hope for this. And although the contradiction between the Black and Korean community is, you know, profound and highly damaging to the hopes, you know, the hopes of a lot of people, it's just important to keep in mind that this event, you know, has been a hybrid event. It's been a contradictory, you know, event. It offers as many, in my mind, as many resources, you know, for hope as it does for, you know, political pessimism. But at all costs right now, I think we must focus on the repression that's going on, bring that to light, and begin to struggle against it. Thank you very much.
For a copy of this program, call the Pacifica Radio Archive at 818-506-1077. That's 506-1077 in the 818.